the whole blade of the sword, if you like, became sharper. I think the Third Reich was on a hiding to nothing. Two or three of their pilots got together and thought, well, you know, why don't we try air-to-air bombing? It looked like a Dandare spaceship. If you stood it up on its fins, that's what it looked like, a cigar-shaped rocket with four fins. And yes, this was a wire-guided missile.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Welcome to the latest episode of Extended, the ETOPS Aviation Podcast. We're ready for takeoff.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson and welcome to episode 126 of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. I'm joined by Robert Forsyth to talk about his book Luftwaffe Special Weapons 1942-1945. Published by Osprey. Robert is an author, editor, and publisher, and he specializes in military aviation. He has his own publishing company and published his first book in 1994. Since then, gone on to write more than 20 books, and many of them focused on the Luftwaffe. He's written for several aviation magazines and is on the editorial board of The Aviation Historian. Robert, welcome to Extended.
Thank you. Hello.
Robert, fascinating book, beautifully produced, which is always a nice thing to have when you receive a book like this. But where did the inspiration for something as specialised and as unique come from to write such a great history?
I'm not sure. That's an interesting question. It's one I've often asked myself over the years, actually. I think I've always been interested in the latter part of the war. So we'll say sort of 1943 onwards. And I think, you know, like many kids growing up in the 1960s and you know, into the sort of mid-70s, it was the era of war films and, you know, war comics and documentaries. And intrigued by the notion that the Third Reich and Germany seem to become more proficient in their weapons designs, the harder and the worse things got for them.
Yeah.
The notion of, you know, that the V2 rocket, alongside things like jet engine technology, really just appealed to my boyhood heart, I suppose. And so I started buying the books, and the more I, you know, as I bought books and I started to, it was an amazing book, which I still have, by William Green, called Warplanes of the Third Reich, stuffed with some fascinating photos and amazing information. And, it's been over the years, it's a little bit dated now, but it was an amazing book for the time. And, you know, I think it introduced a lot of people of my age into that world. And, Yeah, fascinating. So I just got interested in it. And the more I read, the more interested I became in this sort of outlandish, bizarre sort of weapon systems that, you know, against all the adversity, Nazi Germany seemed to produce. And I suppose that's really how I got interested in it. And then as my interest deepened, I started to read more specialist literature, and I started then corresponding with people who were involved, you know, perhaps on the periphery of that whole world. And so I just kept going, and that's really how it all started.
Right. Well, let's put a little bit of context around some of the things we're going to talk about now. We're going to just focus on air to air. I'll come back to that in a bit, because that's what really fascinates us about the book. It would appear to me that reading through the book, there became a greater desperation in the Luftwaffe for more weapons to defend, in effect, the homeland. But was it like that? Was it just the bombing offensive that was taking effect that made them start to invent, design, create such innovative ways of tackling air-to-air combat?
I think it was. If I may, I'll just right. Let's drill back a bit. I'm interested in aviation history, as you said, and I wouldn't grandiosely necessarily call myself an aviation historian, but nevertheless, that's what I study. I study aviation history, and
yeah.
I say that because, and I'm going to say something a little bit controversial here, which will you get all the naval historians and all the land warfare historians reacting. I believe that the Allied strategic air offensive, basically, certainly in the West, won the war. There you are. I've said it.
okay.
And I think that's because, I'm speaking in very broad terms now. Okay, I'm painting in a big brush, but I think that's because the Allied strategic air offensive from sort of early 1943 onwards, as the combined power of the RAF and the Commonwealth Air Forces combined, obviously with American air power, became established, communications became established, organization became established, the whole blade of the sword, if you like, became sharper. I think the Third Reich was on a hiding to nothing. And I think basically the infrastructure was bombed, transport system was bombed, homes were bombed. I mean, people suffered, you know, they couldn't get to work, you know, water pipes were burst. It comes, you know, from some massive level right down to the fact that, you know, if you can't get water coming out of your tap because the water system has been bombed, your morale is going to be affected. And this was going on a massive scale, economically and industrially. And I think by certainly the autumn of 1943, when you've got massive commitment on the part of the Allies, that raids like Schweinfurt and you know, it just intensifies, and the numbers of these bombing raids and the depth of their penetration is just increasing all the time. The Luftwaffe and the German economy and the industrial capacity of Germany, which is fighting a three-front ground war, but now is having to fight a fourth front in the air over the homeland, is just stretched to beyond capacity. And yet, what also happens is that Germany, as a race, as a nation, has always invested in engineering. And throughout the whole of the conflict, German engineering schools, you know, they had specialist technical universities. Engineers were still being trained, and engineers were still going into work for weapons companies. And so, you know, even by 1943, there was a younger generation of very qualified, very well-trained weapons engineers coming into companies like Rheinmetall Borsig, Deutsche Waffenfabrik, these big German weapon companies. These guys were still joining, and they were the generation who had basically grown up with Nazism, but they were still patriots. They were suffering, and their families had suffered from the effect of the Allied bombing campaign, and they were motivated. You know, they had a job to do. And, you know, when these guys and, you know, saw hundreds of flying fortresses flying over their city or their town, you know, they're going to roll up their sleeves. I'm putting it very crudely, but they're going to roll up their sleeves and they're going to sit over the drawing board, and they are going to work to design weapons if they have to. And if that's going to defend the homeland, so be it.
And Robert, there were a number of special weapons. We're going to talk about some now, but there were some techniques as well that you also talk about briefly. You know, everything from disrupting the air in front of fleets of bombers to dropping oil to foul the engines. Was there a specific unit that was set up to focus this engineering effort, to focus this technology?
Well, there were several, but the key unit in terms of what we're discussing today was a unit called Eprobungs Commando 25. And Eprobungs Commando breaks down into Test Command. So the Test Command 25. However, they were the smallish commando detachment, if you like, squadron that was assigned to assess, not necessarily to develop, but to assess operationally or to assess whether such and such a weapon stood a chance going into operations. And this unit was formed of some very skilled airmen, you know, airmen with operational experience. They, in turn, would liaise with and report to the various test centres. There was a major test centre, the major Luftwaffe development test centre was at Rechlin in northern central Germany, but there was another test centre up on the Baltic coast, Tarnowitz. There was a part of the Peenemünde, the famous Peenemünde establishment. There was an offshoot at a place called Karlshagen. So depending on the weaponry concerned, the test centres, which were part of the German Air Ministry and answerable to the German Air Ministry, would liaise with Eprobungskommando 25. And they would come along and the test centres would come along and say, you know, we've got this weapon, whatever it is, a bomb, a rocket, whatever it is. We've devised it. It's been developed by such and such a firm, or it's even been developed by the Air Ministry. Right. You guys have now got to take this into the air and see what happens. We developed. So Eprobungs Commando 25, which was formed at Wittmannhafen, up on the northwest German coast, and later operated from Achmer and various other places. It was a small command led by a man called Hauptmann Horst Geier, who I had the pleasure of meeting several years ago, a very qualified airman. That was the unit that spearheaded and tested and, again, I must emphasize, assessed what these weapons were like. So they had some influence as to whether something, a weapon would eventually go in to squadron service.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's talk about some of the techniques and weapons. Let's start with air bombing, which I have to be honest, I didn't know too much about until reading the book.
Right. Well, the concept actually goes back a long time. In fact, it goes back to the First World War, but you know, we'll stick with our time period. I mean, in fact, in North Africa, there was a German fighter wing, JG-27. And in fact, a pilot from JG-27 was known to fly over the desert in North Africa and had a penchant for dropping hand grenades out of his aircraft into Spitfires and Hurricanes and what have you. Don't know how successful it was, okay. But my point being that it was played with. It became much more sophisticated and more official, if you like, again in the mid sort of 42-43 onwards, where a German fighter unit and as I said, you know, Eprobungs Commando 25 was there to specifically assess and test weapons, but that doesn't mean that weapons weren't tested by other squadrons if somebody had an idea. And we'll come on to this, because the Germans were very open to this. They were always willing to have a go. But there was this unit, Jagdgeschwader 1, JG-1, again based up on in northwest Germany and charged with defending that sort of air corridor into northwest Germany, heading towards Bremen, Hamburg, the important ports, you know, towns like Lübeck as well. They were charged with the defense of northwest Germany. And one of their pilots, two or three of their pilots got together and thought, well, you know, why don't we try air-to-air bombing? Now, you may well ask why. What, you know, how on earth is that going to work? But actually, if you load a 250-kilo high explosive bomb beneath the centerline fuselage of an FW-190 and you drop it, I think I'm right in saying that Allied intelligence said, there was a report that the American 8th Air Force intelligence issued that stated that a flak burst would be the equivalent of a blast spread of 50 feet. If you drop a 250-kilo bomb and it bursts amongst a formation of flying fortresses, you've got a blast area of 300 feet.
So in effect, these bombs had fuses that would explode.
Yes. I mean, okay. Again, I think there's a lot of facts and figures to this subject, as you remember, so forgive me. But I think there were time delay fuses of, I think they could drop a fuse and it would be a 20-second delay fuse from dropping. Now, if you're above, right. if you're above a formation, a bomber formation, actually you count 1,000, 2,000, 3,000. It's actually quite a long time. And you can then preset those, you can preset those fuses up to, depending on your operational mission. But if you go above a formation, if you imagine you're a Focke-Wulf 190 pilot and you're going above a formation of Allied bombers and you drop, you know, your time delay fuse is preset to 5 seconds, 10 seconds, 20 seconds, whatever, and this thing falls into a large but very closely packed formation of bombers and you drop this thing and the skill is getting it to go boom in a formation of bombers. But by that stage in the war, Peter, you've got to think that the American bomber formations were stepped, you know, into various combat wings. So the if you imagine you're looking at the formation flying from east, from west to east into Germany in profile, you've got a lot of bombers stacked on top of each other. So if that bomb is dropped and aimed well, that bomb, the chances are, and the fuse is set properly, it's going to go boom somewhere in that formation. And, you know, 300 feet, that's going to cause some damage.
And collateral as well, collateral damage of and that, falling and that aircraft
is,
and pieces.
Well, the thing is, that was the theory. because, of course, the problem with that is you've got a 250-kilo bomb beneath a single-engine fighter. It's got to get off the ground. It's got to get up there fairly quickly. It's got to get into position, and that means just it's got to find the enemy formation. It's then got to get above the enemy formation. It's then got to drop its bomb. The fuse has to be preset to the right number of seconds. It's got to go into the formation, bang. And there's one other thing, something called the P-51, that might be sort of lurking around. So there were a couple of missions. There was one particular mission where three fortresses were destroyed, you know, just literally destroyed, bang, gone. But I must stress that this was only in the experimental stage. So the relatively few missions that were carried out by this relatively small unit did actually have some effect.
Did you know that the first G-suit for British pilots was essentially a chest-high pair of fisherman's waders which were filled with 2 gallons of water? The water automatically squeezed the pilot's legs as positive G was applied. Did you also know that the Islamic Republic of Iran Air Force's oldest McDonnell Douglas F-4D Phantom is set to clock up more than 70 years in service, having been delivered in 1968 and now subject to life extension programs taking it to 2040? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
Let's move on to rockets then, and you feature a number of examples. I was fascinated to read that the Germans had developed wire-guided air-to-air missiles.
Yes, yeah.
In the Second World War.
There was, there was one weapon called the X-4, which was developed by a company called Ruhrstahl, the Ruhr Steel Company. It had a 20-kilo warhead, and it looked like something from, forgive me, probably our generation would know, you know, it looked like something out of Dan Dare. It was a cigar-shaped rocket. It looked like a Dan Dare spaceship. If you stood it up on its fins, that's what it looked like, a cigar-shaped rocket with 4 fins. And yes, this was a wire-guided missile. So the thing that has to be taken in mind, you know, bear it more in mind, that these Luftwaffe fighter units, they were having to deal with increased, again, this huge thing, yeah, Allied strategic air offensive, more and more and more bombers, you know, the 1,000 bomber raids, hundreds of bombers. With that came mass defensive firepower. You know, these formations were bristling. Before we even worry about escort fighters, these formations were bristling with 50 caliber machine guns. So the age of the machine gun and the cannon, you know, came into question because these guys had to that they needed weapons that they could use much further out beyond the range of the defensive air power. So the X-4 was designed so that a fighter could fire this thing from way out of range and literally control it by wire-guided. You know, it was wire guided, and it had a very hazardous rocket fuel compound that they used this thing called Tonka, and it was a very volatile fuel, but it moved really quickly. I think it was something like 250 meters a second or something. I think something like that into the formation. The problem was that it was almost too sophisticated. And I say that because it would go into the formation fast, but it actually could, fly through the formation and blow up beyond the formation. And it just probably wasn't big enough to do such damage, but it was incredibly sophisticated. It was had a amazing technological guidance system developed by Telefunken. It was built of steel, and as I said, it had a 20-kilo warhead, and a Fokker Wolf 190 was designed, could carry theoretically two of these things under each wing. It just lacked accuracy, and again, it was too little too late. It never got into squadron service, but the technology was phenomenal.
And there were more traditional rockets as well, which were devastating. And, you know, from a Western and Allied perspective, we know of the use of air-to-ground rockets, but air-to-air rockets in batches fired at bomber formations were absolutely devastating.
Yeah, there was a rocket called the R4M, which was a 55-millimeter caliber rocket developed by the Deutsche Waffen Munitions Fabrik. This thing was phenomenal. It was all the trailblazer, really, in terms of air-to-air rocket weaponry. A battery of 12 of these could be loaded under the wing of a fighter under a wooden launch rack. So Germany had lots of wood, so the rack design technology was very basic. And these things would fire off. Batteries of 24 of these things could be fired off singly or in salvos or all together, depending on the fighter and what have you. But, you know, a battery of these things could be fired, and they were quite lethal. And, you know, towards the end of the war, they were equipping the ME-262s, interceptors of the two Luftwaffe units, JG-7 in the north, based on airfields around Berlin, and with Adolf Galland's JV-44 down at Munich Riem in the south. So they were firing rockets at the 15th and 12th Air Force coming up from Austria. And there was a problem is, you know, a 262 is fast, the rockets are fast. That does, again, bring in the question of accuracy. But it had a huge psychological impact. And believe it or not, American air crews were doubted. When this weapon first appeared, American air crews were actually questioned by their intelligence officers as to whether this thing really actually existed. Wow. You know, there was doubt because they didn't believe it.
Yeah.
But I've interviewed, just very quickly, I've interviewed a B-26 Marauder pilot who, a horrific, an R-4M went through the nose, the perspex canopy nose of a B-26, went through the cockpit, took his leg and arm off, went through the fuselage of the B-26, injured one of the gunners, and went out through the rear side of the rear fuselage just before the tail assembly. And the guy actually managed to get that aircraft home, missing his arm and leg.
Wow.
And when that happens, in fact, he landed actually in a tank trap and the aircraft broke up, but he survived and the crew survived. But you can imagine the psychological impact that has on your fellow crews when you know that you're going up against 262s carrying that kind of weaponry.
Moving on to some other techniques used, mortars and aerial torpedoes?
Yeah. Well, mortars, again, what happened with the mortars? They developed a 21-centimeter mortar. It was spin-stabilized, and it was based on the back of an army weapon, the Waffengranate. It was an army mortar. And again, the rationale behind the mortar, air-to-air mortar, was not accuracy. The rationale behind that was to disperse and scatter a bomber formation. Big, heavy things. There were tubes loaded at a slightly upward angle. Upward angle into a formation, fire this thing, and the rationale was that this thing would, a bit like air-to-air bombing, it would blow up in the middle of a formation and scatter the formation, because the number one thing was to break up the formation. If you could break up the formation, the defense was scattered and the fighters could get in and pick up individual bombers and possibly stragglers. And so whilst it wasn't accurate, that was the rationale. But like all these things, it affected maneuverability. ME-110 and ME-410 twin engine fighters would sometimes carry two of these things under each wing. And
it's just amazing.
it did cause effect. They did persist with it. And I suppose, did it do its job? Yes, and I suppose it probably broke up formations. Did it account for many bombers being shot down? Possibly not. You know, it's that kind of thing, yeah.
And how about some other techniques? Upward firing weapons, you talk about several of those. There's also one that, quote, they describe as the volley or the grape shot weapon.
Yes. Well, the Germans, I mean, obviously the night fighter arm had this thing called Schrieger Musik, which was upward obliquely mounted cannon to shoot down bombers at night. In a way, this was a development of that. And again, it's extraordinary. Again, these German engineers, they developed this extraordinary photoelectric cell technology, which was known as the magic eye technology. So in the cockpit, there would be a photoelectric cell. The principle being that if you...
That's amazing.
Yeah, it is. I mean, if you went and you're talking, you're right. I mean, talking 1944, but obviously it had been developed in 1943, a year earlier. So this thing, you know, the rationale being to approach a bomber from the front, or actually also from the rear, go below a bomber. Now, if you go beneath a bomber, you're presented with the largest, you know, you can go above, but that brings in other questions. But if you come up beneath, you've got the largest possible target size. It's the greatest surface area with which to fire a weapon at. But obviously, the pilot can't see everything that he's doing. So he relies on photoelectric cell technology, which picks up the form and shape of the bomber and automatically sends a signal to three or four, or sometimes more, depending on the weapon, obliquely mounted barrels installed either in the rear fuse, in the fuselage behind the cockpit at an angle, mounted at an angle, or there was another weapon called the Harfer, the Harp, which was mounted on the side of the fuselage, which was a lower caliber weapon, but could go up to 25 barrels along the whole aircraft. And these weapons would, the pilot would go under the aircraft, the magic eye, the photoelectric cell technology would kick in and release this battery of 30 millimeter shells upwards into the vulnerable, most weakly defended, but largest surface area of the bomber. And again, Problems Commando 25, under Horst Geier, tested this, and they really put a lot of... It's one of these things where they knew they'd got advanced technology. They knew they had something. They didn't have the time, because you're talking 19... By the time it got into, any kind of operational assessment, the clock was ticking and the Allied bomber offensive had got worse and worse. So they knew they had the technology, but it just was, again, too little, too late. But it was nevertheless remarkable technology. And they developed a range of the SG-116, which was the Zeilendusch, the cell shower, was the upward firing. That was in the fuselage. There was a wing-mounted version, which relied on the upward firing shells going up with a counterweight that fell out in the from the wing, and that was the SG-500 Jägerfaust fighter fist, and that was installed in an ME-163 rocket fighter, the Comet. You know, it's you can imagine this, but again, Peter, you've got to think of the combined closing speeds of these things. I mean, it was still almost just too fast. And then the other series was the SG-117 and 118, as you alluded to, the volley or the great shot, where they took 30 millimeter, they basically built barrels, clusters of 30 millimeter, effectively 30 millimeter gun barrels. And if you imagine the old, Magic Dragon, the helicopter gunships from Vietnam, if you can imagine these great Gatling gun type assemblies, and these were designed for single fire batteries of 30 millimeter rounds, same principle, you know, it was grape shot. It was the more rounds you can fire at once into a formation of bombers rather than going dag, 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 dag with a stream of bullets. The ballistics theory was that you would achieve more from a single volley shot than you would with a stream of, and the fighter would have to be in position for less time because you're talking about margins of seconds. So that was what that series was.
Just before we go, tell me about the Natter.
Ah, the Natter, the Backham Natter. Well, you had to have poor pilots had to have a pretty good life insurance policy. So that was a vertical takeoff interceptor, which was basically launched from a vertical tower or pole, and was designed to go at incredibly high speed. It was a point defense interceptor. So the philosophy was that it would be based around, say, the synthetic fuel factories, the important areas of industry, so that when a bomber formation was detected coming in, these things would be launched up into the bomber formation, and their nose would contain clusters of 55 millimeter R4Ms, 30 millimeter cannon shells like the SG-117 series. And this wooden high-speed rocket interceptor would climb rapidly, like the ME-163, up into a formation of bombers. The engine would cut out, it would level out, and it would glide in towards the bomber formation, fire its weapons, and then the aircraft would split up, and a parachute would release and bring the pilot back down to Earth. And
holy smoke.
It was incredible. And also, but it never got beyond the experimental stage. They did do a manned launch. The poor guy lost his life. But if I can just quickly mention again, the philosophy was that this would be eventually taken into very crude launch towers, literally telegraph poles or that kind of thing. So the one thing Germany had a lot of was wood, forests, timber. It was cheap to use. It was cheap to get. They had a lot of it. And if you could build one of these things next to a wooden launch tower, it was easy to do. So it was kind of the common sense and the technology and the rationale always mated with a slightly batty set of circumstances, that's the dichotomy, really, and that's why I find it fascinating.
It is, and we've only just touched on the air-to-air weapons, but the book also contains air-to-ground, ground-to-air, and all sorts of other weaponry as well, and is an absolutely fascinating read, Robert.
Yeah, and you mentioned, and very quickly, if I could just mention, you very quickly mentioned at the beginning about artificial air schools, that, you know, they didn't turn down anything. And there was one, and I've seen the report from the Imperial War Museum, that there was a report on creating artificial gusts of air, and again to destabilize bomber formations. But they had the idea of dropping steel nets and chemicals and towed cable bombs, and they never turned down anything. And again, that's what makes this whole thing fascinating.
Yeah, and that's all in the book. Where can we find the book and you online, Robert?
Well, the book is available through Osprey Publishing, my publishers. They run it on the website, their website, and it is also available at Amazon, where I have a little author page, and presumably all good bookstores.
Thanks so much, Robert, for joining us today.
Thank you very much indeed. Great stuff. And keep up the good work as well, Peter.
Thank you. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter, and you can find Gareth Timonelli on the extended Twitter, Facebook and Instagram feeds. So that's it. With the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Robert and me.
Cheerio.
And remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
The cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
It's taken me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Knowing how to recognise a store being taught like visually and the basic PPL, it wouldn't bother me.
Thanks for listening to Extended. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to Extended. We'd also like to thank the Extended family of supporters, including Mick Oakey at the Aviation Historian. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website, so please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme is produced with a Creative Commons licence.
Extend it!
This is XTP Media.